This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Next Tuesday, November 5th, voters in Onslow County will decide the fate of a bond referendum allocating $75 million for the school system. The money will be used for security upgrades, major maintenance projects, and the replacement of two schools built in the 1920s. Associate Superintendent for Human Resources Barry Collins says the need for improvements is great.
Onslow County Schools is the 13th largest school district in the state of North Carolina. We're the second fastest growing school district.
Each year, approximately 350 students are added to the Onslow County school system. In 1991, there were 27 schools in the district. Over the span of 20 years, 10 new schools were built to accommodate the growth. Collins says the influx of people moving to the area has put a huge burden on existing infrastructure.
These are very critical needs for the school district. If this bond passes, it will be the cheapest way for our county to pay for it.
A long-range facility needs assessment conducted in December 2011 found that the school system would need 3,500 additional seats to handle future needs at the current rate of growth. The estimated cost to build new elementary schools, replace aging facilities, perform major scheduled maintenance, and install safety and security technology is $149 million.
That was presented. It was approved by our board. It was presented to the county commissioners. And we're on the way with the $149 million to be put on the ballot. About 3 days later, the school board reconvened and decided that the $149 million was just too much to ask our citizens to pay for at this time, considering the economic situation.
The school board reconfigured items on the list to include only essential repairs and construction to be done in the next 2 to 3 years. Collins says they were able to cut cost in half to $75 million.
$6 million of that is for safety and security, which is the enhanced cameras and monitoring systems, the new door locks, the scan card readers, the call buttons at the front office, and the identification and check upgrades. We also have the ability with the software that our law enforcement can be notified and they can actually pull up on their system what our cameras are looking at.
Collins says security upgrades will be installed at all 37 Onslow County school sites. The bulk of the $75 million bond referendum will go to replace the aging Dixon Middle School and Richlands Elementary School.
One of the things that is important to note is that everyone agrees that the needs are there. We've had no one really contest us on whether or not we need these things.
Onslow County residents are concerned with how the bond referendum, if approved, will impact their pocketbooks. While the school board does not levy taxes, Collins has been told the property tax increase would only be about 2 to 6 cents on every $100. Given the average property value in Onslow County is $178,700, the estimated increase to the average homeowner would be about $60 per year. For more information on Onslow County Schools bond referendum, go to publicradioeast.org and click on this story. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. On Monday, the Department of Cultural Resources underwater archaeology team performed their last dive of the season to recover artifacts from Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, and it was a huge success. 5 cannons and 2 large concretions were brought up from the bottom of the ocean floor, making it the largest one-day recover of cannons so far. This week, Public Radio East's Mac McKee spoke with the director of the State Office of Underwater Archaeology, Steve Claggett, about the dive.
Your department is in charge of Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, and the recovery of artifacts. Tell us about your most recent find, Steve.
Well, just this week, at the end of this fall's dive season, we recovered 5 iron cannons from the wreck of Queen Anne's Revenge, along with a couple of large masses of artifacts called concretions. Did all that with the irreplaceable help of the U.S. Coast Guard crew of the Cutter Smilax operating out of Fort Macon.
What are the approximate ages, I guess, of the cannon that you recovered?
Well, we'll know more as we get into the conservation, but they date to the late 17th century, very early 18th century, obviously before 1718 when the ship went down.
Now, I also heard of that maybe one of those cannons could have been manufactured in Sweden.
Absolutely. We're guessing at that, but on pretty good evidence from a similar, if not identical, cannon we recovered about 7 or 8 years ago, which once that one was cleaned up, it was found to be of Swedish origin and had the actual date of 1713 cast into part of the cannon. So we think one of the five we recovered this week is the twin to that gun.
Looking back in history, that would be accurate because Sweden in the early 18th century was a major Baltic power at that time.
Exactly. And one of the things about, you know, being a pirate, like others, Blackbeard would have carried a variety of guns and ordnance on his ship, probably from different countries, either traded or captured from other vessels as suited his needs, but it would not have been a uniform collection of guns, all from England, for example, or France.
Steve, where do the cannons and the artifacts in general, where do they go for cleanup and restoration?
Well, everything recovered from the wreck, as soon as it's recovered, is transported up to our Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Laboratory in Greenville, North Carolina, where we operate a state-of-the-art facility in partnership with East Carolina University. And all conservation and study of materials, including cannons and everything else from the wreck, it's all done there by our staff.
Now, the artifacts have been on tour for quite some time now. In fact, they just finished up an extensive stay at the Maritime Museum in Beaufort. Can you give us an idea of where they will be for the rest of the year and on into next year?
Well, there is, as you said, a fairly extensive exhibit, permanent exhibit there at the Maritime Museum, but we also have a traveling exhibit, which has been moving around the state from state-owned historic site one to another, but also including some museums. Started out in Asheville, oddly enough, but so that people out in the western part of the state could look at some of those materials. Right now, the traveling exhibit is in at Charlotte Hawkins Brown State Historic Site near Burlington. But people can find out more about that by visiting either the Department of Cultural Resources website or the North Carolina Maritime Museum website.
Now, I understand that this project has been going on for a very long time, since the discovery of these ships in 1996. How long have you been involved with the project, Steve?
Since 1996. So, actually, a little before. The discoverers of the shipwreck, as required by state law, have to have permits, exploration permits, from me, a state archaeologist acting on behalf of the department. So I had been engaged with these people through the permit process for quite a number of years, even before the Queen Anne's Revenge was found.
Now, I understand that this may be one of the last dives for the year and maybe a last recovery dive for some time. What are you going to do in the interim, just study what you have?
Well, first they're going to catch their breath. Our crews have been out for the last 12 weeks. They've just this week closed up the site for the winter at least. We have every intention of going back out early next summer and working on through the summer and even up into the fall. Of course, everything's controlled by money, so among other things, we'll be doing a lot of fundraising over the winter to support the project.
This project, in some ways, until you can you're satisfied about exploring every inch of the wreck, will keep going on for some time.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm sure that the response at the Maritime Museum and at other places has been phenomenal, because people are always interested in the most interesting pirate, Blackbeard.
Absolutely. We never lack for press coverage. In fact, that's paid off already this year. Just this morning, we were contacted by two different individuals from Sweden who had read about it in the international press, and some interest and background in working with Swedish foundries and studying Swedish cannon. So that's a little added benefit of all the great publicity we get.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for being our guest.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Carteret General Hospital. Announcing a fundraising dinner to benefit the new cancer center at Carteret General Hospital, Saturday, November 2nd, 6 p.m. at the Country Club of the Crystal Coast. Entertainment and live auction, limited seating reservations at 808-6646. This is PRE Public Radio East. On Sunday, November 10th, the poet of the violin, Joshua Bell, will be performing at Wright Auditorium on the campus of East Carolina University in Greenville at 8 p.m. This week, Public Radio East's Finley Woolston spoke with him about the recital.
Joshua Bell is one of the great violinists of his age, or any age for that matter. Mr. Bell, thanks for talking with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, I'd like to begin with what might be self-evident, but perhaps not. Why the violin? Why not, the piano, piccolo? I don't know. Why the violin?
It's hard for me to remember not playing the violin, really. It's like remembering the time before I could speak. I've had it since I was 4 years old. I hardly remember why I started on it. My parents just gave me a little violin, and I took to it very quickly, and it just became part of my life. I don't feel like a pianist or a flute player. I can't imagine myself doing anything other than the violin.
One of the reasons I ask is another pretty well-known violinist, Niccolo Paganini, started out on the mandolin, and he was 5 years old and didn't really pick up a violin until he was an oldster of seven, I think.
He did pretty well for himself.
Yeah, he certainly did. You know, here in eastern North Carolina, there is a very vibrant and widespread Suzuki program. Did you come up as a Suzuki kid?
I did. I mean, I started in a sort of modified version of Suzuki method and started playing went through the Suzuki books and played with other kids. And I think it's wonderful. It gets kids interested. It makes it social and fun for them. I think it's very important that kids enjoy and that it's fun and not a chore. And because getting kids to stick with it is sometimes the hardest part. And so I think Suzuki is a nice option.
I understand you play a Stradivarius violin, the 1713 Huberman Strad. Gets its name from the Polish virtuoso Bronislaw Huberman, who played it until it was stolen in 1936. Tell us a bit about that, can you? And how did that end up living with you?
He actually played for Brahms. Brahms' violin concerto when he was, I think, a nine-year-old. So I grew up, hearing about Huberman from my teacher, Joseph Gingold. He had a picture of Huberman on his wall in his studio. And his violin, the Strad, was famous for having been stolen from him at Carnegie Hall in New York in 1936, disappeared from backstage, and he never saw the violin again. It disappeared until 1986 when it was... It revealed that the thief, who was very young at the time, had been playing on it for 50 years himself. He never tried to sell it and just played gigs on it as a violinist his whole life until his 80s, I think. I don't know how old he was exactly, but on his deathbed, he's confessed to having stolen it. So then it kind of came back to the world and got into the hands of a great violinist, Norbert Breinin, from the Amadeus Quartet, and whom I knew, and I knew the instrument a tiny bit. I had played a few notes on it one time and loved it. And then in 2001, I stumbled upon it at the violin shop in London.
I just have to ask you about this. What is arguably your most famous film appearance, the 2007 busking episode there in Washington, D.C. in the Metro stop?
Yeah, I guess that's probably the thing that will be on my tombstone now, I guess.
Certainly has gone viral. It's a street clothes, incognito, violin case open. I don't know. You put a little seed money in there in the violin case?
I think that's how it started. I put in a few coins, and then I didn't do so badly. I made like $39 or something in 40 minutes, so it's not so bad. Not my favorite experience, but it was kind of funny how it was done as a sort of social experiment, stunt, and it's just funny to me how it sort of carried on virally that was already almost 7 years ago, and we're still talking about it. I played many things that day in that 40 minutes, but the one thing I did that probably ended up on YouTube was the Bach Chaconne, one of the great pieces, maybe the greatest piece written for solo violin. And I tried to play it as seriously as possible. It actually was in a cavernous, you know, metro station with actually wonderful sound. So it's, but you know, most people, it was during rush hour, and most people just you know, just rushed past.
Well, you at least made train fare then. All right, well, that's good. You have a new CD out, just released, Musical Gifts from Joshua Bell and Friends. And my gosh, what a list of friends. Alison Krauss, Chick Corea, Renee Fleming, Branford Marsalis. Well, Whitten couldn't make it, I guess. I don't know.
Hopefully Whitten will be on the next one. Branford is an incredible sax player. And then, you know, others like Gloria Stefan and Placido Domingo and Renee Fleming. Chris Bodie, it was so much fun to do, and as much fun doing these arrangements and working, you know, so that we can hear a lot of popular songs, things we know, but in very unique and different ways, and that's something I've always enjoyed doing.
Yeah, it's certainly a great lineup and a great project to have coming out right now, of course. Mr. Bell, we can't let you go without talking about your upcoming visit to Eastern North Carolina. You'll be in recital Sunday, November the 10th, 8 in the evening, in Wright Auditorium on the campus of East Carolina University, ably assisted by pianist Sam Hayward. What's on the bill? What are you going to be doing?
Well, it's let's see. On this program, we're starting with a Baroque sonata of Tartini, The Devil's Trill, which is a fun way to start, and virtuosic way to start. And then the most ethereal and beautiful of the Beethoven sonatas, the 10th sonata. And then on the second half, Stravinsky Divertimento for violin and piano, a transcription from his ballet, The Fairy's Kiss. And then we'll see some, you know, little pieces that we'll decide in the moment.
Which reminds me, you know, I've often wondered, I like to ask musicians, how do you personally pick an encore piece? Do you plan it, spur of the moment, or how do you do that?
Well, usually, you know, before you go on tour, we'll figure out what would go well after you've, you know, thinking how, after you've heard the whole program, what would be a nice change up or relevant piece to play at the end. And so usually we'll have a little bag of things to pull from, and then at the end we can kind of play it depending on how the audience feels.
You know, November the 10th is the birthday of the United States Marine Corps, and there are a lot of current and former Marines around here. Maybe a spirited version of the Marines hymn or Semper Fidelis or something
okay,
like that.
Okay, that's an idea. I'll keep that in mind.
That would get you. That would definitely get everybody on their feet again after the standing O. Thank you so much for joining us, and our best for continued success, and we'll see you on November the 10th. I guarantee you, I personally will be right in the front row.
Oh, good. You must come say hi. Looking forward to coming to you.
I will come up and say hello. I appreciate that.
Okay, cheers. Take care.
Halloween is over, but if you didn't get quite enough fright to last you on Thursday night, spend the weekend with the writings of Boone horror novelist Scott Nicholson. He's nothing if not prolific, with over 20 novels to his credit, plus numerous short stories, with 10 years of those short stories compiled in the collection Scattered Ashes. George Olson spoke with the author and has this, which originally aired in May 2009.
Scott Nicholson says he's not a violent man, that he couldn't even kill a chicken, but still.
Sometimes you can get cheap revenge in stories that way. I don't know how many former bosses I have killed off in stories.
The Boone-based Nicholson is a horror writer, which gives you all sorts of possibilities to vent a little rage. He's just released a collection of short stories entitled Scattered Ashes that covers a period from 1998 and 2008, a period where he also wrote several novels. It was also a period of personal turmoil, which the writing helped to quell.
I went through a painful divorce. Well, is there any good divorce? And just struggling with my parenthood and personal issues. And a lot of those stories, I even go into it in the afterword there about these stories kept me sane, and they're also a touchstone of where I was and what I was going through. And not all of it's pretty, but it feels human.
The most personal of those short stories could be Watermelon, which tells the story of Ricky, a man who is constantly berated by his wife, who reads of a domestic murder that no one foresaw. The more Ricky reads, the more similarities he sees in his domestic situation and the fated couple. As the similarities pile up in his head and his wife's verbal assaults continue, the rage in Ricky rises until...
At the time, as my first separation, and I had this little apartment, and was doing a lot of drinking late at night and had this watermelon, and for some reason this rage built up, and I was tearing the red stuff out and then started punching it, and it's like, man, I'm glad this isn't a person. And I flung it out the door across the road and watched it sploosh, and then later I was thinking, yeah, that's kind of metaphorical, that could have been a person. I'm just venting my rage on this watermelon and swelled that into a story.
Ricky thrashes a watermelon, just as Scott Nicholson had done earlier. No people, fictional or otherwise, were harmed. It was an incident Scott describes as a little bit embarrassing, but definitely fitting his line, "It's not pretty, but it is human." There's much of the not pretty in his writing, more so than straight horror, which tends to involve monsters that bump in the night according to most people's delineation of the genre. In fact, several of the stories in Scattered Ashes, while they have a ghostly twist, are based on two real situations, where Scott almost seems to be saying that real life for some is horror enough, as in this from The October Girls, about Ellen, the beaten child of a drunken mother, and her imaginary, or quite possibly ghostly, friend Margaret.
Ellen found Margaret beside a church white marker. "Mom's going to be mad," Ellen said. "She's just an old meanie." "She's really going to kill me," Ellen sat in the grass beside Margaret, and dew soaked her dress. "Don't go back," Margaret said. "I have to go back." Margaret folded her arms across her chest and stuck out her lower lip. "In the summer, we got to play until way late." "It's not summer anymore," Ellen said, looking at the sky. Three stars were out. "Is that why the fireflies are gone?" Ellen laughed. "You're such a dummy head." She poked Margaret in the side, feeling the hard ridges of her friend's ribs. It was funny how invisible friends could be solid if you thought of them that way. "Sometimes it's hard to remember," Margaret said, sniffing. "You know, what it was like." Ellen poked again. "It's not that great."
That type of real life is horror enough writing with a ghost story interwoven inside is also found in The Night is an Ally, which is Scott's imagining of time in the German Reserve Police Battalion 101, a police formation put at the disposal of the German Army during World War II. Battalion 101 was responsible for the shooting deaths of 38,000 Jews during a 15-month period.
Sounds like there was a struggle that some people would not go out and kill Jews. And some of them were like, "Hey, it's a chance to get away with murder. I don't like these people anyway. Now I got freedom to kill them and not have any punishment." And just that turning, and where's that point in your mind that clicks and says, "Hey, it's okay to, these people are subhuman." And that just fascinated me, and the whole psychological journey of, did they all really want to kill Jews, or was it a few, and who encouraged, and then what does it take to persuade someone to make that shift? It's kind of horrifying, because I think that switch is maybe in all of us, and we just don't know where it is until we get there.
While short stories such as The Night is an Ally derive most of their horror from real life, Nicholson's Scattered Ashes collection does delve in straight horror. What's a horror novel without a few zombies? And also pays homage to horror past in Last Rites.
I was actually solicited for that project. Edgar Allan Poe left this fragment of a story about a page that was unfinished, and all the writers in this anthology were challenged with finishing that story, and we got a co-author credit with Edgar Allan Poe, which is always cool.
Nicholson even goes so far as to write Poe into the story as a lighthouse keeper whose sanity is on edge with the job's isolation.
"Are you not a lover of the sea?" I said. "I would have thought someone taking a post such as this..." "Must be mad as a hatter," he said, looking glumly into his glass. "4 months here and I've barely even started." "I don't understand," I said. He gestured toward the papers on the table. "My work." "You keep a record of the currents, tides, and ships?" "Not that work. I mean my writing." "You're a writer then?" "Yes, I used to be a newspaper reporter, but I'm driven to write of false things. I thought with the change of scenery and blessed isolation..." "You have plenty of both here, I imagine. I know something of isolation myself." He gave a grim smile, as if his loneliness were the deepest in all the world and weighed most heavily on his shoulders. He drank more liquor in gulps instead of sips and refilled his glass. My legs were trembling from the long climb, but the only place to sit was his bed. I had never been in a man's bed. "Isolation is the devil's tool," Poe said. "I want to concentrate on my work, but one hears things in this damnable cylinder. The rush of high tide sounds like voices in the chamber below, like the soft cries of those who have been pulled under the water. Think of all those ships lying on the ocean floor yonder, and the white bones of those who went down with them. Where do you suppose they go?
I'm going off what you read and just the crazy, demented guy who drank a lot and basically seemed pretty unhappy. And did the writing make him mad? Did the writing help him deal with his madness? Or was it all just fiction and maybe he was a relatively stable and happy guy? But of course, it makes for a much better story if he's crazy.
In Scott Nicholson's case, the writing and the occasional watermelon thrashing seem to have kept him in check. Scattered Ashes, a collection of short stories by Boone author Scott Nicholson, is published by Dark Regions Press. I'm George Olson.